I wanted to go to Nepal to live because I think I would be happier in Nepal. Our Lama teacher looked quite serious, looked as if this was a matter of extreme importance instead of being the idle fancies of boys who didn't know what they were talking about. He replied gravely, "But do you know the Nepalese people very well? Have you had any real experience of them besides the very few you have met? Do you know of the lower types of Nepalese people? If not, if you have not frequently been in their homes, then you cannot know if you would like them. I say that if you want to stay here in Tibet, then you should devote all your thought to Tibet. But if you want to go to Nepal, then you should leave Tibet now and go to Nepal and think no more of Tibet, for if one divides one's thoughts, one divides one's forces. We can have a good stream of thought, or force, or we can have the scattered raindrops which cover a wide area but have no force. Each of you must decide what you want to do, what you want to be, and having decided, then each of you must concentrate wholeheartedly and with undivided mind on achieving what you want to be, for if you decide to go to Nepal with one half of your mind and the other half decides to stay in Tibet, then you are in a state of indecision the whole time, you are worried the whole time, and you cannot at any time then obtain peace of mind or tranquility. That is one of the great forces of the world, one of the great laws which you must remember. Divide the enemy and you can rule the enemy, stay united yourself and you can defeat a divided enemy. The enemy can well be indecision, fear, and uncertainty. We all looked at each other, and we thought how well this particular teacher understood us. It was so very much better having a man who was a man to whom we could talk and who would talk back with us and not just at us. We thought of our Indian teacher, how supercilious he was. I said, "Honorable Master, I have a question. Why is it that some lamas are so very cruel and others are so understanding and so kind?" The teacher smiled a little and said, "Why, Lobsang, it's rather late at night to delve into such weighty matters, but I promise you that we will deal with such things, and we will also deal with the uses and abuses of religions. But I think now we have worked long enough for one day, so let us go each of us about his own business." He stood up, and all the boys stood up with him. The Lama saw that I was having difficulty, so he bent over, put an arm around me, and just helped me to my feet as easily, as calmly, as if he was used to doing it every day of his life. "Go along, now, boys," he said, "otherwise you will be stumbling and falling in the darkness of the corridors and we don't want any more people who have temporary leg injuries." The boys all rushed away, full of happiness because we had finished rather more early than usual. The Lama teacher turned to me before leaving and said, "Lobsang, your guide will be returning in the morning. I doubt if you will see him until the afternoon, or even until the evening, because he has to make a special report to the inmost one and to the members of the upper council. But he has sent a message that he is thinking about you, and the inmost one has sent a message to him saying how pleased his holiness is with you. And, Lobsang, your guide had something for you." With that he smiled at me, gave me a light pat on the shoulder, turned and left. I stood for a moment or two wondering why the inmost one should be pleased with me when I was so tattered and battered, and when in the eyes of others I had caused so much trouble, and I also wondered what my beloved guide had for me. I could hardly bear to think what he might have for me, because never in my life had I had any gift bestowed upon me. I turned and stumped out of the room just as the old cleaning monk entered. He greeted me in a friendly fashion and inquired most kindly about my legs. I told him that they were slowly mending, and he said, "I was cleaning in the Lama's quarters today and I have heard them saying that you are destined for great things. I have heard them say that the Holy One is very, very pleased with you." I exchanged a few more words, helped the old man light the butter lamps, and then I went on my way going down and down, reluctantly passing the corridor to the kitchens and going, instead, into one of the minor temples. I wanted to be alone, wanted to think, wanted to meditate on the past and contemplate upon the future. In a Lama Sari there is little privacy for an acolyte, or more accurately, a kila, because kila is the Buddhist term, and if we ever were overcome with sorrow or problems, Then the only place that we could be alone was in one of the minor temples where we could get behind one of the larger of the sacred figures where no one would disturb us. So I went down and entered a dimly lit temple where the butter lamps were sputtering, showing that someone had got water in with the butter. The lamps were sputtering and sending up gouts of black smoke which were leaving marks upon the walls, leaving marks on a tanker. I walked on and on, past the smoldering incense burners, and turned to my favorite statue and sat down beneath its shadow. As I sat there was Ra, and a friendly black head butted me in the small of my back, and then great fairy feet made their way onto my lap and started knitting, while the cat went on purring louder and louder. For some moments I played with the old cat, rubbing his fur, pulling his tail and tweaking his ears, and all the time he purred louder and louder. Then suddenly, like a lamp going out, his head dropped and he fell asleep on the lap of my robe. I clasped my hands and thought of all the incidents of my life, thought of all the difficulties. I pondered about the present, thinking how easy it was for people to give one platitudes about religion, thinking how easy it was for one to say of the rules of right living. But it was not so easy when one was a small boy and had just been forced into a career or vocation without the slightest inclination or desire for such career or vocation. So thinking, I must have drifted off to sleep, sitting upright as we often did when we slept. The old cat slept, and I slept as well, and time passed us by. The lengthening shadows outside became darker and darker, the sun ran its course and disappeared. Soon over the edge of the mountains peered the face of the silver moon, and all the houses of Lhasa had the little butter lamps flickering behind their windows. And I and the old cat, we slept in the shadow of the sacred figure. Chapter 7. A deep droning buzz penetrated my sleeping mind. Somewhere nearby, very much thought power was being poured onto the receptive air. My telepathic powers were stirred. I lifted my nodding head and tiredly opened my drooping eyelids. I was tired. A slight stir on my lap, and a loving mouth took a gentle grip of my hand and squeezed with affection. "Oh, Muno," said the old guardian cat. He looked up at me with deep understanding. The faint flicker of a butter lamp reflected blood red from eyes that were sky blue by daylight. Softly, so softly that I was aware of it only after he had left, the cat slid from my lap and emerged with the palpable shadows. Oh! My legs were stiff, the scarce healed bones felt as if they were grating. The tight, deep burn scar gave the impression that it would at any moment peel away from the flesh to leave again a raw and gaping wound. Waves of pain shot up my limbs and whirled fierce talons of pain along my spine, threatening to tear my ribs from their seatings. I lay still, gasping. As the spasm slowly faded, I cautiously looked about me. Here, in the deep purple shadow of the great sacred figure, I could see, unseen. The windows were outlined as dark rectangles on a wall of dancing shadows. Through the glassless frames I could see the night sky as a black pool of smoothest velvet sprinkled with bright jewels of light. Diamonds, rubies, and turquoise dots twinkled and swirled above. Here, in the high thin air of Tibet, stars were seen in color, not like white specks of light as in lower pans of the world. Here there were no rolling clouds of smoke to sully the purity of the sky and obscure the grandeur of the heavens. Mars was red, a pale ruby. Venus was green, while the little speck of Mercury was as a splinter of turquoise. Faint finger marks as a finely crushed diamond dust stretched in a band as far as I could see. Tonight there was no moon to compete with and swamp the feeble starlight. On the walls the shadows leapt and postured, now being of giant figures stretching to the roof, now squat dwarfs scrabbling on the floor. Off to the side near me a butter lamp was damaged. From its battered bottom there came a gluck-gluck as melted butter seeped out, then a splat. As the congealing liquid spattered on the floor. Against a distant wall by the side of a window a tanker fluttered as almost as though it were a moth straining to reach the flickering flames. It clattered slightly as it bulged away from the wall, vibrated, and then sank back as ex-house did, only to repeat again and again. For a moment I had what was almost an attack of vertigo. I had awakened suddenly from sleep, And now as I looked about, the shadows moving and writhing and twisting, and the different cadences of the voices at the other side of the sacred figure, it rather bemused me. I looked up, up at the back of the head of the great figure behind which I crouched. For a moment I felt panic. The figure was toppling, toppling, it was going to fall on me and crush me. The outlines wavered, and I got ready to throw myself sideways, hampered as I was by my damaged legs. But suddenly, I almost laughed out loud. It was the illusion of life through the flickering of the shadows. By now the pain had somewhat subsided. I got on my hands and knees and softly crept around the edge of the figure, so that I could peer into this, one of the innermost of the temples. I had never seen a service in this temple before. We boys were rigidly excluded. For us it was the main temple, or one of the more common of the minor temples. But this, hollowed in the rock far beneath the man-made structure, I wondered what it was, what they were doing here. Cautiously, pulling my robe around my waist so that I should not trip over it, I edged forward and peered round the corner. This was interesting, I thought. In front of me in a circle were 9 lamas, all in their saffron robes, all with their heads facing the center of the circle, and in the center upon an ornately carved stand was something, something which I could not clearly distinguish. There seemed to be something, and yet there seemed to be nothing there. I shivered, and the shaven hair of my head stood rigidly erect like guards on parade, for the chill fingers of fear had reached out and touched me, stimulating me so that I was ready to flee. I thought that on that carved stand stood a creature from the shadow world, a creature which had no real existence in this, our world, and hardly any existence in the other world from whence it came. I stared and stared. It seemed to be a globe of something, or a globe of nothing. It seemed to be almost without form, and yet what form there was rippled. I wish I could go closer, and peer over the head of one of the seated lamas, but that would be sure detection. So I sat back, and rubbed my hands into my eyes trying to wipe away sleep, trying to make them more alert, trying to make them see better in this haze and gloom. Satisfied that I had done as much as I could to my eyes, I crouched forward again on hands and knees, and stared, shifting my position slightly to get a better view between the shoulders of 2 lamas. I saw, it occurred to me suddenly, that this was an enormous rock crystal, flawless, perfect. It reposed upon its carved stand and commanded the attention of the lamas who sat almost in devotion before it. They eyed it intently, and yet not so intently as to engage their physical eyes, but instead it seemed to be a use of the third eye. Well, I thought, I, too, am clairvoyant. So I stared no more with my eyes. Instead, I let my clairvoyant faculties come into play, and in the crystal I saw colors, swirls, whirls, and a smoky turbulence. Amazingly, frighteningly, I seemed to be falling, falling from an immense height, falling from the top of the world down into an abyss. But, no, it was not an abyss. Instead, a world was stretching out in front of me, a world where there were different colors, different standards. I saw as from slight eminence people wandering about full of misery, full of sadness, some were full of pain. They were lost souls, souls without guidance, souls pondering on a method of release from their worries. As I sat there entranced, as though I were on the sunlit plain of a different world, the chants of the lamas droned on. Every so often one would reach out a hand and ring a silver bell, another opposite would do the same with a different tone of bell. And so they would go on with their chants, their music sliding up and down the scale. Not in notes staccato as in other pans of the world, but here a glissade of notes, sliding one into the other, merging into chords which echoed from the walls and reverberated and made chords of their own. The leader of the lama group clapped his hands, the one next to him rang a bell, and the third of the group lifted up his voice in a ritualistic chant, "Oh, listen, the voices of our souls." And so they went on from one to the other repeating the age-old stanzas. First one at a time, then in unison, the cadence of their voices rising and falling, lifting me out of time, out of myself. Then came the whole set of prayers of this group. Oh! Listen to the voices of our souls, all you who cower in the wilderness, unprotected. Listen to the voices of our souls that we may protect the unprotected. As the first stick of incense is lit and the smoke rises upwards, let your soul and your faith rise also, that you may be protected. Oh! Listen to the voices of our souls, all you who cringe with fear in the night. Listen to the voices of our souls, for we will be as a lantern glowing in the darkness that we may guide benighted wayfarers. As the second stick of incense is lit and glows with life, let your soul perceive the light we shine that you may be guided. Oh! Listen to the voices of our souls, all you who are stranded at the gulf of ignorance. Listen to the voices of our souls, our help shall be as a bridge to cross the chasm, to assist you farther on the path. As the third stick of incense is lit and the smoke trails, let your soul step forth bravely into light. Oh! Listen to the voices of our souls, all you who are faint with the weariness of life. Listen to the voices of our souls, for we bring you rest that rested your soul shall sally forth anew as the fourth stick of incense is lit and the smoke idly drifts. We bring rest that, refreshed, you may rise renewed. Oh! Listen to the voices of our souls, all you who scoff at holy words. Listen to the voices of our souls. We bring you peace, that you may dwell upon immortal truths. As the fifth stick of incense is lit to bring fragrance to life, open your mind that you may know. The sound of the chanting died away. Alarma raised his bell and tinkled it softly. Others picked up their bells and tinkled them. First they all rang separately, and then, according to some prearranged pattern, they all rang out together, forming a special tonal scheme which echoed and reverberated, and varied in pitch and intensity. The lamas continued their deep droning, repeating again, "Oh! Listen to the voices of our souls," ringing their bells, droning on. The effect was hypnotic, mystical. I continued to look at the people about me, or were they about me? Was I in some other world? Or was I looking in a crystal? My strong impression was that I was in another world where the grass was greener, where the sky was bluer, where everything stood out in sharp, vivid contrast. There was the green sward beneath my feet, good gracious, I could feel it with my bare toes. I could feel moisture seeping through my robe where my knees were in contact. My hands, too, as I gently scuffed them, seemed to feel grass and perhaps here and there a stone or two. I looked about me with avid interest. There were great boulders in the foreground, of a greenish stone, here and there streaked with white veins. Other boulders were of different colors. One to which I was particularly attracted was of a reddish hue, reddish with milk-white strands running through it. But what impressed me most was the manner in which everything stood out with stark reality. The manner in which everything looked more normal than normal, with brighter colors, with sharper outlines. There was a gentle breeze blowing, I could feel it above my left cheek. It was rather astonishing because it bore upon it strange scents, exotic odors. Some distance away I saw something that looked like a bee. It was buzzing along, and it landed and entered the trumpet of a little flower growing in the grass. All this I saw without consciously being aware of the passage of time, but then I became alarmed, wary, for there was a whole group of people coming my way. I looked at them and I was powerless to move. They were coming towards me and I was more or less in their path. Here, as I looked at them, I sensed something very much amiss. Some of the people were old people who leaned upon sticks and who hobbled along barefooted, clad in tattered rags. Others were obviously men of wealth, but not with the general air of well-being which affluence usually brings. For one thing stood out particularly about these men and women: they were miserable, frightened. The slightest movement made them jump and clasp their hands across their breasts. They looked nervously about them, and not one seemed to be aware of his neighbor. They seemed to feel that they were alone, forgotten, desolate, and abandoned in some alien world. They came on, each one an individual aware only of his own existence, and yet they came in a group, no one touching the other, no one aware of the presence of another. They came on lured by the voices which I, too, could hear. Oh! Listen to the voices of our souls, all you who wander unguided. The chant and the droning went on and the people came on also, and as they came to a certain spot, I could not see what actually was happening. Each face lit up with a sort of unearthly joy. Each person stood more erect, as if he or she had received an assurance and felt the better therefore. They moved along out of my sight. Suddenly there was a clash of bells in dissonance, and I felt a violent jerk within me as if someone was reeling me in, as if I was a kite at the end of a string being drawn in against a gale which tried to loft it farther. As I looked out upon that strange landscape, I had the impression that night was falling, for the sky was darkening and the colors are becoming less distinguishable. Things seemed to be shrinking. Shrinking? How could they shrink? But undoubtedly they were shrinking, and not only were they becoming smaller, but a fog like the clouds above was beginning to cover the face of that world, and as my horrified gaze took in the scene getting smaller and smaller, the fog changed into black thunder clouds shot with lightning. The world was getting smaller and smaller, and I was rising upwards and upwards. As I looked down, I could see it rotating beneath my feet, and then I decided, of course, it was not rotating beneath my feet because I was on my hands and knees in the temple. Or where was I? I was confused and dazed, and then once again came that sharp, terrific jerk, a jerk which nearly spun my brain out of my head. Quite dizzy for the moment, I raised my hand to rub my eyes. And then I gazed again, and I saw before me that the crystal was a crystal once again, no longer a world, just a crystal lying dull and lifeless with no point of light within it. It stood upon its carved base as though it were a stone, or an idol, or anything, not as the most wonderful instrument of wonderful experiences. Slowly a lama rose to his feet and took from the base a cloth. It looked like black velvet. Reverently he unfolded the cloth and draped it over the crystal and then tucked it in. He bowed three times in the direction of the crystal, and turned away to resume his seat. As he did so, his astonished gaze fell on me. For some seconds there was a stunned, shocked silence. Time itself seemed to have been paralyzed. I could just hear my heart give one loud thump. And then no more. There was an impression that the whole of nature, the whole of time, was listening in hushed suspense to see what would happen next. There was a mutter between the lamas. The one nearest me stood up and towered over me. He was the biggest of the lot, but to my terrified eyes he looked bigger than the Potala itself. He towered over me and started to speak, but then another lama recognized me. "It is Minya's boy, Lobsang," he said, rather relieved. "This is our most telepathic boy. Bring him here." The giant lama reached down and put his hands beneath my arms and lifted me up, for, being told that I was Minya's boy had given him the knowledge that I could not easily walk, and so he saved me the trouble. He carried me into the circle of lamas, each one looking at me as if they were going to peer into my soul, as if they were going to peer through my soul, beyond, and into other realms leading to the overself. I was in a considerable state of fright because I did not know that I had done anything particularly wrong. I had chosen this particular temple because some of the others were always thronged by small boys who were not seriously interested in meditation. I was. "But what was that, Lobsang?" said a small, wizened lama. "What were you doing here?" "Honorable master," was my reply, "it has long been my habit to come to the minor temples for private meditation, and I sit behind one of the sacred figures where I cannot disturb anyone else who is meditating. I had no thought of intruding upon your service. In fact, I looked rather shamefaced. I fell asleep, and I was only awakened when I heard your service about to start." Off to the left, the leaking butter lamp had ceased its splat, splat, and suddenly there came a short hiss as the floating wick, now deprived of liquid butter, expired and was extinguished against the metal. For seconds it smouldered red, and then there was the acrid, rancid smell of charring wick. From outside our circle came a familiar mro. "Mro." Friend Cat importantly pushed his way between two lamas, walked to me with tail erect and butted me in friendship. I reached out a trembling hand and riffled my fingers through his fur. He turned to me, gave another butt, and said "Ara," and sedately stalked off, pushing his way between two more lamas. The lamas looked at each other, and a faint smile played about their lips. "So, our guardian here knows you well, Lobsang. He spoke well for you, too. He assured you of his devotion and told us that you had spoken the truth. For a few moments there was silence. One of the younger lamas turned his head and saw the cat haughtily stalking away. He chuckled and turned back to the group. The old, wizened lama, who seemed to be very much the senior, and who was in charge of the service, looked at me then turned to each of his fellows, remarking, "Yes, I remember, this is the boy who has to have special instruction. We were waiting for the return of his guide before summoning him here, but as he is here let us test his experience and his capabilities so that we may assess him without the influence of his powerful guide." There was a murmured agreement, and low-voiced suggestions which I was far too confused to follow. These were the high telepathic lamas, the high clairvoyants, the ones who helped others, and now I was sitting with them, sitting shivering with fright, it is true, but still sitting with them. One of them turned to me and said, "Lobsang, we have heard so much about you, about your innate powers, about your possibilities, and about your future. In fact, it is we who investigated the record of probabilities to see what would happen in your case. Now, are you willing to undergo some ordeal in order that we may determine the extent of your powers? We want to take you for a walk in the astral, and in the world below the astral, we want to take you as a ghost through our Potala." I looked at him dubiously. Take? How did they think I could walk? I could hobble about the corridors, but my legs were not yet healed enough to enable me to walk with any degree of confidence. I hesitated, thought about it, and twisted the hem of my robe. Then I replied, "Honorable masters. I am very much in your power, but I have to say that I am not able to walk much because of my accidents. But, as a good monk should, I place myself at your disposal hoping that my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, would approve of my decision." No one laughed, or even smiled, at what must have sounded to be a very pompous statement, for I was young and inexperienced, and after all I was doing my best and who can do more than one's best? "Lobsang, we want you to lie prone, we have to have you prone because your legs will not permit you to be in the orthodox position. Therefore, you must lie prone." The old lama carefully took a seat cushion and placed it beneath my head. Then he placed my hands with fingers clasped so that my two hands with fingers entwined were between the end of the breastbone and the umbilicus. Then they rearranged themselves, they shifted the crystal to one side, reverently placing it in a place that I had not previously noticed, in the base of a sacred figure. They sat about me so that my head was in the exact center of the circle. One lama broke away from the group, and returned with sticks of incense and a small brazier. I almost disgraced myself by sneezing as a trailing cloud of smoke crossed my face and made my nostrils itch. Strangely, my eyes were getting heavy. I had a sense of. But the lamas were not looking at me, they were looking at a point far above me. I forced open my eyes, and I could see under their chins, I could see up into their nostrils, their heads were so far tilted that I could not distinguish their eyes. No, they were not looking at me, they were looking, where? The incense smoldered on making a small sizzling noise which I had not noticed before. Suddenly I clutched my hands even more tightly because the whole building seemed to be rocking. I had heard of earthquakes, and I thought that suddenly we of the Potala were being afflicted with an earthquake. Panic welled up within me and by great effort I managed to suppress it, thinking that it would be a disgrace to my guide if I scrambled to my feet and scuttled out of the temple while the lamas sat placidly on. The swaying continued, and for a moment I felt almost sick. For a moment I felt that I was drifting up, I found that one of the beams of the roof was a few inches from my hand. Idly I put out my hand to ward myself off, and to my terror my hand went right through the beam, not even disturbing the dust which lay upon its surface. With the terror of that experience, I sank down rapidly and landed on my feet by the side of a sacred figure. Quickly I put out my hand to steady myself, knowing that my legs would not support me. But again, my hands went right through the sacred figure, and my legs felt firm and strong, I had no pain, no discomfort. I turned quickly, the group of lamas was still there. But, no. One was absent. He was, I perceived, standing beside me, and his hand was about to touch my elbow.